Ayrım 6.
Sayfa 55. But it is in what Plato has to say about the mass of the citizens and their education that the fascination of the laws resides. In the Republic, the role of ordinary people in the state corresponds to that of appetite in the soul. But the relation between reason and appetite is depicted as a purely negative one. Reason restrains and checks the non-rational impulses of appetite. In the laws, the positive development of desirable habits and traits takes the place of this restraint. The common people are encouraged to live in accordance with virtue, and both education and the laws are to nurture them in this way of life. But when they live in accordance with the precepts of virtue, it is because they have been conditioned into and habituated to such a way of life, and not because they understand the point of it. That understanding is still restricted to the rulers. This emerges most clearly in discussion of the question of the existence of the gods or God. For sophisticated Greeks of Plato's period, singular and plural expressions about the divine appear to be interchangeable. In the Republic, explicit references to the divine are sporadic. Stories of the traditional gods, purged of immoral and unworthy actions, will have their part in education. But the only true divinity appears to be the form of the good. In the laws, however, the existence of the divine has become the cornerstone of morals and politics. The greatest question is whether we do or do not think rightly about the gods and so live well. The divine is important in the laws because it is identified with law. To be obedient before the law is to be obedient before God. The divine also seems to represent the general primacy of spirit over matter, soul over body. On this is founded the argument for the existence of God introduced in Book 10. The ordinary people are to be induced to believe in gods because it is important that all men should believe in gods who attend to human affairs and who are not subject to human weakness in that attention. But the rulers are to be men who have toiled to acquire complete confidence in the existence of the gods by intellectual effort. What others hold as a result of conditioning and tradition they have grasped by the use of the rational proof. Suppose, however, that a member of the ruling group comes to think that he has found a flaw in the required proof. What then? Plato gives a clear answer in Book 12. If this doubter keeps his doubts to himself, then well and good. But if he insists on disseminating them, then the nocturnal council, the supreme authority in the hierarchy of Magnesia, will condemn him to death. The absence of Socrates from the dialogue is underlined by this episode. His prosecutors would have had an even easier task in Magnesia than they had in Athens. Plato's determination to uphold the paternalistic and totalitarian politics is clearly independent of any particular version of the theory of forms. For long after he has abandoned the version which in the Republic helps to sustain such a politics, he is prepared to advocate the political views which is sustained. But it is also clear that Plato's political philosophy is not merely only justifiable if, but is only intelligible if, some theory of values as residing in a transcendent realm to which there can be access only for an intellectually trained elite can be shown to be plausible. This is the connection between the non-political vision of the symposium and the entirely political vision of the laws. But what is the turn in Plato's thought which transformed Socrates from hero into potential victim? We can distinguish at least two turning points. The first is the rejection of the Socratic self-knowledge through the discovery of one's own ignorance. The second is the belief that to give true answers to the Socratic questions somehow imposes an obligation to incarnate these answers in social forms. This belief is a curious blend of political realism with totalitarian fantasy. That the possibility of living a virtuous life depends for most people upon the existence of the right kind of social structure does not entail that we ought to create a social structure in which virtue is imposed. Indeed, on Plato's own view, virtue is not imposed. It is either rationally apprehended by the few, or it is impossible, its place being taken by an externally conforming obedience for the many. But it does not follow that Plato did not believe in imposing virtue, but rather that the confusion embedded in his beliefs obscured from him that this was what he believed in. Chapter 7. Aristotle's Ethics. Every craft and every inquiry, and similarly every action and project, seems to aim at some good. Hence, the good has been well defined as that at which everything aims. The book which Aristotle opens with this trenchant sentence is traditionally known as the Nicomachean Ethics. It was either dedicated to or edited by Aristotle's son Nicomachus, but its subject matter is declared to be politics. And the work which is called the Politics is presented as the sequel to the Ethics. Both are concerned with the practical science of human happiness, in which we study what happiness is, what activities it consists in, and how to become happy. The Ethics shows us what form and style of life are necessary to happiness, the Politics what particular form of constitution, what set of institutions are necessary to make this form of life possible and to safeguard it. But to say only this is misleading. For the word politikos does not mean precisely what we mean by political. Aristotle's word covers both what we mean by political and what we mean by social, and does not discriminate between them. The reason for this is obvious. In the small-scale Greek city-state, the institutions of the polis are both those in which policy and the means to execute it are determined, and those in which the face-to-face relationships of social life find their home. In the assembly, a citizen meets his friends. With his friends, he will be among fellow members of the assembly. There is a clue here to the understanding of parts of the Ethics, which later on we shall have to follow up. For the moment, we must return to the first sentence. Good is defined as the outset in terms of the goal, purpose, or aim to which something or somebody moves. To call something good is to say that it is under certain conditions sought or aimed at. There are numerous activities, numerous aims, and hence numerous goods. To see that Aristotle is completely right in establishing this relationship between being good and being that at which we aim, let us consider three points about the use of the word good. First, if I aim at something, try to bring about some state of affair, that I so aim is certainly not sufficient to justify my calling whatever I aim at good. But If I call what I aim at good, I shall be indicating that what I seek is what is sought in general by people who want what I want. If I call what I am trying to get good, a good cricket bat, or a good holiday, for example, by using the word good, I invoke the criteria characteristically accepted as a standard by those who want cricket bats or holidays. That this is genuinely so is brought out by a second point. To call something good and to allow that it is not a thing which anyone who wanted that sort of thing would want would be to speak unintelligibly. In this, good differs from red. That people in general want or do not want red objects is a contingent matter of fact. That people in general want what is good is a matter of the internal relationship of the concept of being good and being an object of desire. Or to make the same point in a third way. If we were trying to learn the language of a strange tribe, and a linguist asserted of one of their words that it was to be translated by good, but this word was never applied to what they sought or pursued, although its use was always accompanied, say, by smiles, we should know a priori that the linguist was mistaken. If, then, there is some one goal among those which we pursue in our actions, which we desire for its own sake, and if we desire other things for its sake, and if we do not choose everything for the sake of something else, in that case we should proceed to choose ad infinitum, so that all desire would be empty and futile. It is plain that this would be the good and the best of goods. Footnote: Nicomachean Ethics, Book 1, 1094a. Aristotle's definition of the supreme good leaves it open for the moment whether there is or is not such a good. Some medieval scholastic commentators, doubtless with an eye to theological implications, rewrote Aristotle as if he had written that everything is chosen for the sake of some good, and that therefore there is one good for the sake of which everything is chosen. But this fallacious inference is not in Aristotle. Aristotle's procedure is to inquire whether anything does, in fact, answer to his description of a possible supreme good, and his method is to examine a number of opinions which have been held on the topic. Before he does this, however, he issues two warnings. The first is to remember that every sort of inquiry has its own standards and possibilities of precision. In ethics, we are guided by general considerations to general conclusions, which nonetheless admit of exceptions. Courage and wealth are good, for example, but wealth sometimes causes harm, and men have died as a result of being brave. What is required is a kind of judgment altogether different from that of mathematics. Moreover, young men will be no good at politics. They lack experience and hence they lack judgment. I mentioned these dicta of Aristotle only because they are so often quoted. Certainly, there is something very middle-aged about the spirit which Aristotle breeds. But we ought to remember that what we have now is the text of lectures, and we ought not to treat what are clearly lecturers' asides as if they are developed arguments. Aristotle's next move is to give a name to his possible supreme good. The name eudaimonia is badly but inevitably translated by happiness, badly because it includes both the notion of behaving well and the notion of faring well. Aristotle's use of this word reflects the strong Greek sense that virtue and happiness, in the sense of prosperity, cannot be entirely divorced. The Kantian injunction, which a million Puritan parents have made their own, "Do not seek to be happy, seek to be deserving of happiness," makes no sense if eudaimo and eudaimonia are substituted for happy and happiness. Once again, the change of language is also a change of concepts. In what does eudaimonia consist? Some say in pleasure, some say in wealth, and some say in honor and reputation, and some have said that there is a supreme good over and above all particular goods, which is the cause of their being good. Aristotle dismisses pleasure rather brusquely at this point. "The many in choosing a life fit for cattle exhibit themselves as totally slavish," but later on he is to deal with it at great length. Wealth cannot be the good, for it is only a means to an end. And men prize honor and reputation not as such, but they prize being honored because they are virtuous. So honor is envisaged as a desirable byproduct of virtue. Thus happiness then consists in virtue. No, because to call a man virtuous is to talk not of the state he is in, but of his disposition. A man is virtuous if he would behave in such and such a way, if such and such a situation were to occur. Hence, a man is no less virtuous while asleep or on other occasions when he is not exercising his virtues. More than this, however, a man can be virtuous and wretched, and such a man is certainly not eudaimo. Aristotle at this point challenges not merely the Kantians and the Puritans to come, but also the Platonists. Plato, in both the Gorgias and the Republic, looked back to Socrates and asserted that it is better to suffer tortures on the rack than to have a soul burdened with the guilt of doing evil. Aristotle does not confront this position directly. He merely emphasizes that it is better still both to be free from having done evil and to be free from being tortured on the rack. The fact that, strictly speaking, what Aristotle says and what Plato says are not inconsistent could be misleading. The point is that if we begin by asking for an account of goodness which is compatible with the good man suffering any degree of torture and injustice, the whole perspective of our ethics will be different from that of an ethics which begins from asking in what form of life doing well and faring well may be found together. The first perspective will end up with an ethics which is irrelevant to the task of creating such a form of life. Our choice between these two perspectives is the choice between an ethics which is engaged in telling us how to endure a society in which the just man is crucified, and an ethics which is concerned with how to create a society in which this no longer happens. But to talk like this makes Aristotle sound like a revolutionary beside Plato's conservatism. And this is a mistake, for indeed Plato's memory of Socrates ensures that, even at his worst, he has a deep dissatisfaction with all actually existing societies, while Aristotle is in fact extremely complacent about the existing order. And yet Aristotle is at this point in his argument far more positive than Plato. No one could call a man suffering miseries and misfortunes happy unless he were merely arguing a case. Plato's making goodness independent of any this worldly happiness follows, of course, from his concept of the good as well as from his memories of Socrates. It is this concept of the good which Aristotle now proceeds to attack. For Plato, the word good's paradigmatic meaning is given by considering it as the name of the form of the good. Consequently, good is a single and unitary notion. Of whatever we use it, we ascribe the same relationship to the form of the good. But in fact, we use the word in judgments in all the categories. Of some subjects, such as God or intelligence, of the mode of a subject, how it is, the excellence it has, its possession of the right amount of something, its existence in the right time or place for something, and so on. Moreover, on the Platonic view, everything that falls under a single form should be the subject of a single science or inquiry. But things that are good are dealt with by a number of sciences, such as, for example, medicine and strategy. Thus, Aristotle argues that Plato cannot account for the diversity of uses of good. Moreover, the phrases Plato uses to explain the concept of the form of the good are not in fact explanatory. To speak of the good itself, or as such, does not clearly add anything to good. To call the form eternal is misleading. That something lasts forever does not render it any the better, any more than long-enduring whiteness is whiter than ephemeral whiteness. Moreover, knowledge of Plato's form is of no use to those in fact engaged in the sciences and crafts in which goods are achieved. They appear to be able to do without this knowledge perfectly well. But the heart of Aristotle's criticism of Plato is in the sentence, "For even if there is some unitary being which is the good, predicated of different things in virtue of something they share, or existing separated itself by itself, plainly it would not be something to be done or attained by a man. But it is something which is just that which we are now looking for. That is, good in the sense in which it appears in human language, good in the sense of that which men seek or desire, cannot be the name of a transcendental object. To call a state of affairs good is not necessarily to say that it exists or to relate it to any object that exists, whether transcendental or not. It is to place it as a proper object of desire, and this brings us back to the identification of the good with happiness in the sense of eudaimonia. That happiness is the final end or goal, the good, and that more than a name is involved here, appears from considering two crucial properties which anything which is to be the final end must possess, and which happiness does in fact possess. The first of these is that it must be something which is always chosen for its own sake, and never merely as a means to something else. There are many things which we can choose for their own sake, but may choose for the sake of some further end. But happiness is not among these. We may choose to pursue intelligence, honor, pleasure, wealth, or what we will for the sake of happiness. We could not choose to pursue happiness in order to secure intelligence, honor, pleasure, or wealth. What sort of could not is this? Clearly, Aristotle is saying that the concept of happiness is such that we could not use it of anything but a final end. Equally, happiness is a self-sufficient good, By self-sufficiency, Aristotle intends that happiness is not a component in some other state of affairs, nor is it just one good among others. In a choice between goods, if happiness were offered along with one but not the others, this would always and necessarily tilt the scales of choice. Thus, to justify some action by saying, happiness is brought by this, or happiness consists in doing this, is always to give a reason for acting which terminates argument. No further why can be raised. To have elucidated these logical properties of the concept of happiness is not, of course, to have said anything about what happiness consists in. To this Aristotle turns next. In what does the final end of a man consist? The final end of a flute player is to play well, of a shoemaker to make good shoes, and so on. Each of these kinds of man has a function which he discharges by performing a specific activity, and which he discharges well by doing whatever it may be well. Have men, therefore, a specific activity which belongs to them as men, as members of a species, and not merely as kinds of men. Men share some capacities, those of nutrition and growth, with plants and others, those of consciousness and feeling with animals. But rationality is exclusively human. In man's exercise of his rational powers, therefore, the specific human activity consists, and in the right and able exercise of them lies the specific human excellence. Aristotle advances this argument as though it were obvious, and against the background of the general Aristotelian view of the universe, it is obvious. Nature is composed of well-marked and distinct kinds of being. Each of these moves and is moved from its potentiality to that state of activity in which it achieves its end. At the top of the scale is the unmoved mover, taught unchangingly thinking itself, to which all things are moved. Man, like every other species, moves toward his end, and his end can be determined simply by considering what distinguishes him from other species. Given the general vision, the conclusion appears unassailable. Lacking it, the conclusion appears highly implausible. But very little in Aristotle's argument is affected by this. For when he proceeds to his definition of the good, he depends only on the view that rational behavior is the characteristic exercise of human beings, in the light of which any characteristically human good has to be defined. The good of man is defined as the activity of the soul in accordance with virtue, or if there are a number of human excellences or virtues, in accordance with the best and most perfect of them. What is more, it is this activity throughout a whole life. One swallow does not make a summer, nor one fine day. So one good day or short period does not make a man blessed and happy. Happy, that is a predicate to be used of a whole life. It is lives that we are judging when we call someone happy or unhappy, and not particular states or actions. The individual actions and projects which make up a life are judged as virtues or not, and the whole as happy or unhappy. We can see, says Aristotle, the connection between happiness thus understood and all those things which are popularly thought to constitute happiness. Virtue, though not man's final end, is an essential part of the form of life, that is, pleasure is taken by a good man in virtuous activity, and hence pleasure rightly comes in. A modicum of external goods is needed for characteristic human well-being and well-doing, and so on. We have two large questions on our agenda as a result of Aristotle's definition of the good for man. There is the question to be answered at the end of the Ethics as to the activity in which the good man will be chiefly employed. And there is the question of the excellences of the virtues which he has to manifest in all his activities. When Aristotle proceeds to the discussion of the virtues, he subdivides them in accordance with his division of the soul. Aristotle's use of the expression soul is quite different from Plato's. For Plato, soul and body are two entities, contingently and perhaps unhappily united. For Aristotle, the soul is form to the body's matter. When Aristotle speaks of the soul, we could very often retain his meaning by speaking of personality. Thus, nothing peculiar to the Aristotelian psychology turns on his distinction between the rational and non-rational parts of the soul. For this is simply a contrast between reasoning and other human faculties. The non-rational part of the soul includes the merely physiological as well as the realm of feelings and impulses. These latter can be called rational or irrational in so far as they accord with what reason enjoins, and their characteristic excellence is so accord. There is no necessary conflict between reason and desire, such as Plato envisages, although Aristotle is fully aware of the facts of such conflicts. We therefore exhibit rationality in two kinds of activity. In thinking, where reasoning is what constitutes the activity itself, and in such activities other than thinking, where we may succeed or fail in obeying the precepts of reason. The excellences of the former Aristotle calls the intellectual virtues, of the latter the moral virtues. Examples of the former are wisdom, intelligence, and prudence, of the latter, liberality and temperance. Intellectual virtue is the consequence, usually, of explicit instruction, moral, of habit. Virtue is not inborn, but a consequence of training. The contrast with our natural capacities is plain. First, we have the natural capacity, and then we exercise it. Whereas with virtues, we acquire the habit by first performing the acts. We become just men by performing just actions, courageous by performing courageous actions, and so on. There is no paradox here. One brave action does not make a brave man, but continuing to perform brave actions will inculcate the habit in respect of which we call not merely the action, but also the man brave. Pleasures and pains are a useful guide here. Just as they can corrupt us by distracting us from habits of virtue, so they can be used to inculcate the virtues. For Aristotle, one sign of a virtuous man is that he gets pleasure from virtuous activity, and another is that he knows how to choose among pleasures and pains. It is this matter of virtue as involving choice that makes it clear that virtue cannot be either an emotion or a capacity. We are not called good or bad, we are not praised or blamed, by reason of our emotions or capacities. It is rather what we choose to do with them that entitles us to be called virtues or vicious. Virtuous choice is the choice in accordance with a mean. This notion of the mean is perhaps the single most difficult concept in the Ethics. It will be most conveniently introduced by an example. The virtue of courage is said to be the mean between two vices, a vice of excess, which is rashness, and a vice of deficiency, which is cowardice. A mean is thus a rule or principle of choice between two extremes. Extremes of what? Of emotion or of action. In the case of courage, I give way too much to the impulses which danger arouses when I am a coward, too little to them when I am foolhardy. Three obvious objections at once arise. The first is that there are many emotions and actions for which there cannot be a too much or a too little. Aristotle specifically allows for this. He says that a man can be afraid and be bold and desire and be angry and pity and feel pleasure and pain in general, too much or too little. But he says also that malice, shamelessness, and envy are such that their names imply that they are evil. So also with actions such as adultery, theft, and murder. But Aristotle states no principle which will enable us to recognize what falls in one class, what in the other. We can, however, attempt to interpret Aristotle at this point and try to state the principle implicit in his examples. If I merely ascribe anger or pity to a man, I thereby neither applaud nor condemn him. If I ascribe envy, I do so condemn him. Those emotions of which there can be a mean, and the actions which correspond to them, are those which I can characterize without any moral commitment. It is where I can characterize an emotion or action as a case of anger or whatever it is, prior to and dependently of asking whether there is too much or too little of it, that I have a subject for the mean. But if this is what Aristotle means, then he is committed to showing that every virtue and vice are mean and extreme for some emotion or concern with pleasure and pain, characterizable and identifiable in non-moral terms. Just this is what Aristotle sets out to show in the latter part of Book 2 of the Ethics. Envy, for example, is one extreme and malice another, of a certain attitude to the fortunes of others. The virtue which is the mean is righteous indignation. But this very example brings out a new difficulty in the doctrine. The righteously indignant man is one who is upset by the undeserved good fortune of others. This example is perhaps the first indication that Aristotle was not a nice or a good man. The words supercilious prig spring to mind very often in reading the Ethics. The jealous man has an excess of this attitude. He is upset even by the deserved good fortune of others. And the malicious man is alleged to have a defect here, in that he falls short of being pained. He takes pleasure. But this is absurd. The malicious man rejoices in the ill fortune of others. The Greek word for malice, epeirakakia, means this. Thus what he rejoices in is not the same as what the jealous and the righteously indignant man are pained by. His attitude cannot be placed on the same scale as theirs, and only a determination to make the schematism of mean, excess, and defect work at all costs could have led Aristotle to make this slip. Perhaps with a little ingenuity, Aristotle could be amended here so as to save his doctrine. But what of the virtue of liberality? The vices here are prodigality and meanness. Prodigality is excess in giving, deficiency in getting, and meanness is excess in getting, deficiency in giving. So these are not, after all, excess or defect of the same emotion or action. And Aristotle himself half admits that to the virtue of temperance and the excess of profligacy, there is no corresponding defect. Men deficient in the enjoyment of pleasure scarcely occur. Thus the doctrine finally appears as at best of varying degrees of usefulness in exposition, but scarcely as speaking out something logically necessary to the character of a virtue. Moreover, there is a falsely abstract air about the doctrine. For Aristotle does not, as he might seem to, think that there is one and only one right choice of emotion or action, independent of circumstances. What is courage in one situation would in another be rashness, and in a third cowardice. Virtuous action cannot be specified without reference to the judgment of a prudent man, that is, of one who knows how to take account of circumstances. Consequently, knowledge of the mean cannot just be knowledge of a formula. It must be knowledge of how to apply the rules to choices. And here the notions of excess and defect will not help us. A man who is suspicious of his own tendency to indignation will rightly consider how much envy and malice there is in it. But the connection of envy and malice with indignation is that in the one case I evince a desire to possess the goods of others, and in the other I evince a desire for the harm of others. What makes these wrong is that I desire that what is not mine should be mine, without thought for the deserts of others or myself, and that I desire harm. The viciousness of these desires is in no way due to their being excess or defect of the same desire, and therefore the doctrine of the mean is no guide here. But if this classification in terms of the mean is no practical help, what is its point? Aristotle relates it to no theoretical account of, for example, the emotions, and it therefore appears more and more as an arbitrary construction. But we can see how Aristotle may have arrived at it. For he may have examined everything commonly called a virtue, looked for a recurrent pattern, and thought that he had found one in the mean. The list of virtues in the Ethics is not a list resting on Aristotle's own personal choices and evaluations. It reflects what Aristotle takes to be the code of a gentleman in contemporary Greek society. Aristotle himself endorses this code. Just as in analyzing political constitutions, he treats Greek society as normative, so in explaining the virtues, he treats upper-class Greek life as normative. And what else could we have expected? To this, there are two answers. The first is that it would be purely unhistorical to look in the Ethics for a moral virtue such as meekness, which enters only with the Christian Gospels, or thrift, which enters only with the Puritan Ethics of work, or for an intellectual virtue such as curiosity, which enters self-consciously with systematic experimental science. Aristotle himself, in fact, exhibited this virtue, but perhaps could not have envisaged it as a virtue. Yet this is not good enough as an answer, for Aristotle was aware of alternative codes. There is in Aristotle's Ethics not merely a contempt for the morality of artisans or of barbarians, but also a systematic repudiation of the morality of Socrates. It is not just that the undeserved suffering of the good man is never attended to, but when Aristotle considers justice, he so defines it that the enactments of a state are unlikely to be unjust, provided that they are properly enacted, without undue haste and in due form. It cannot, therefore, generally speaking, be just to break the law. Moreover, in the discussion of the virtues, the defect of the virtue of truthfulness is the vice of the self-deprecator, which is named eironeia, irony. This is a word closely associated with Socrates' claim to ignorance, and its use can scarcely have been accidental. Thus, at every point where a reference to Socrates occurs in Aristotle, we find none of Plato's respect, although a deep respect for Plato himself is shown. It is difficult to resist the conclusion that what we see here is Aristotle's class-bound conservatism, silently and partisanly rewriting the table of the virtues, and so from yet another point of view, suspicion is cast upon the doctrine of the mean. The detail of Aristotle's account of particular virtues is rendered with brilliant analysis and perceptive insight, especially in the case of courage. It is much more, as I have just suggested, the list of virtues which raises questions. The virtues discussed are courage, temperance, liberality, magnificence, greatness of soul, good temper or gentleness, being agreeable in company, wittiness, and lastly, modesty, which is treated as not a virtue but akin to one.